Jeannie Stein is the best-selling author of the urban fantasy series The Anna Strong Chronicles. In 2008, she was named Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers Writer of the Year, and last year, her character, Anna Strong, received a Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award for Best Urban Fantasy Protagonist. Crossroads, the seventh book in the Anna Strong Chronicles, was published by Ace Books in August of this year.
So, jumping right in, you recently released Crossroads, is
correct.
That correct? The
yes.
seventh book in the Anna
yes.
Strong series?
Yes.
It's a series about a vampire bounty hunter.
Correct.
Okay, for anyone who hasn't read the books, tell us a bit about the series.
The Anna Strong vampire series is the story of a woman who became a vampire mm-hmm. in the course of working her day job, which was a bounty hunter. Mm-hmm. The progression of the books is how she has adjusted
right,
to this life
right.
as a vampire. She still has a human family, so she has people that she is close to. And in my world, vampires aren't out. They are still an underground, they keep their identity secret. They're
yeah.
an underground society. Right. They have a hierarchy, but they are not known to the general public.
Okay.
So she's undergoing this balancing act between...
She's trying to live a human life
exactly,
still. Right,
exactly.
Right.
And retain... and hiding her nature, hiding the fact that she's now a vampire from the people that she loves.
Very interesting.
It's important to her.
Where is Anna at in at the time of Crossroads?
At Crossroads, this is the seventh book in the series. Mm-hmm. She has just completed her first year as a vampire.
Okay.
All the six books that precede Crossroads took place in the period of a year, so the time frame is close.
Mm-hmm.
The books are set close to each
right,
other.
Right.
This is the first book that takes place after she's completed her first year and after she's accepted the mantle of the Chosen One, which means she's the head of the vampire hierarchy. She's the leader of the vampire world,
okay.
is what it is. Now, this hasn't affected her everyday life so much to this point, but in Crossroads, she finds out that there is a shaman, or she hears a rumor that there is a shaman in the living among the Navajos in Monument Valley.
Oh, okay.
And he can restore life, mortality to the dead. So she's
unmade vampires.
Well,
or?
This is it. She seeks him out. She seeks him out to see if there's a possibility that she could become human again.
Right.
But part of the decision that she has to make is because she is now head of the vampire. We call it the 13 tribes
okay.
of the vampires. She knows that there's a faction that does not want to remain hidden. They want to. They feel like they should be at the top of the food chain. They want
sure.
to assume. What they see is their rightful place. In other words, subjugating. They think they should be subjugating humans, and they
sure.
should be the leaders of the world. Well, so in Crossroads, then she goes to visit the shaman with one of her friends, who is a shapeshifter by the name of Daniel Frey.
Okay.
She's been very close to, because. Actually,
that's
a recurring character in the,
series. Yes, yes.
In the series, and as it turns out, he actually has a son that lives on the same Navajo reservation with his mother. And they have been, Daniel Frey and his wife have been estranged for a long time. She did not know when she got pregnant that he was a shapeshifter, and because of that, she just decided that she's wanted to divorce herself from
yeah.
that
right,
life.
Right.
So the story revolves around them going to the Navajo village
yeah.
to seek out the shaman, and for Anna to make the decision of whether or not, if it's possible, she wants to become mortal.
And so this
again,
is a serious point of character development for her, because
yes.
she's been struggling with the vampiric nature
exactly.
for so long.
Exactly. And she has actually sent her, she has parents living, she has a niece living. She has sent them out of the country to protect them, because
mm-hmm.
especially with the different factions that are kind of at war in the vampire world,
right. Right.
she didn't want them to get caught in the
right.
crossfire. This is what happens with new vampires. Especially the older ones that have been around for centuries don't have any living relatives that
they
are
no
that they're close
to
or that
world.
Yes
yeah.
that could be used as a threat against
sure.
them. So that's how the story, that's what the story of Crossroads is about. It's about Anna's decision. She goes to seek the shaman, she beats him, and then she has to make the decision about, very cool. He helps her.
Now, you've already finished the eighth book in the series.
I've already finished the eighth book.
And there's a ninth plan.
There's a ninth plan.
The final book in the series?
Well, you know, the publishing business is one of those strange businesses where it was put to me like this. They would like me to go to create another series, to create another world, another character. And so they said, wrap up the Anna Strong series with the ninth book, but leave it open-ended. So that, in other words, don't kill anybody important off. And, you know, so that you can, you know, possibly pick the series up again in the future.
Now, as the storyteller of the series, do you find that somewhat limiting? I mean, or do you feel comfortable finding a resolution that
can
remain open-ended?
Well, I have some loose ends that have kind of come down through the series that I want to tie up.
Yeah.
But, and I think that finally Anna is going to meet the person that she can spend the rest, well, not the rest of her life, because she's immortal and this person
the
isn't,
rest, yeah.
But she's going to finally develop a relationship that's going to be a lasting relationship.
Okay.
Because up to this point, you know, she's had pretty bad luck with men. She either scares them off or, you know, or kills them off. You know, she hasn't had very good luck with boyfriends.
Now, I was looking at your blog, The Biting Edge.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yes.
Yes.
Very entertaining.
With Mario.
It's wonderful.
Right.
Seems that you've mentioned a few times, many, many times perhaps, your love of the Whedonverse.
Oh, yes.
I mean, how much inspiration is there when you create these sort of like character, like
a
the
lot.
Relationships with it? For
yeah. Yeah, yeah, a lot, especially with the idea of a vampire living among mortals and living a relatively normal life. The creation of Angel was the first time that I'd seen a vampire in a series that wasn't all bad.
Right.
You know, that
right.
wasn't just purely the antagonist or the villain.
Well, in the history that they, I mean, not to, I'm going to geek out for just a second.
No.
But the history that where that character comes from, the reason that he, you know, that he has a soul.
Yes.
And the backstory that they get into with him is just so well done that it really... It creates character momentum that paid off for years in the series, and in a book series like yours, you know, to put those pieces in place.
And that is the genius of Joss Whedon, as far as I'm concerned, because now he did say that I've seen interviews, mm-hmm. you know, read interviews with him, and he does plot a series, so he or a television series. He'll plot it out 10 seasons, mm-hmm. so he knows. But it's wonderful that he can drop a line that you think is a throwaway line in season 3, episode 2, and it comes back in season 7, and you go, oh my God.
No, we actually,
the squeeze off the charts.
Yeah.
Nick, who you met briefly, he runs our the Rapo Library's graphic novel book club,
which
I'm in.
Yeah.
And so we actually, this topic came up last night of comparing Battlestar Galactica with, say, something like anything Joss Whedon has done, where I love the BSG guys because they would write so daringly. They would just say, let's do it.
Yes.
But then they wouldn't have a plan. So sometimes they wrote themselves into a corner, I felt like, compared to just, I think, the harder art of from day one.
Exactly.
Knowing where you might be in 10 years. Yeah.
Exactly. And Joss is really good, too. He handpicked this great group of writers to work with him. And they had his vision, and
like,
they had
Espenson
his story arc.
Jane Espenson and some of the
Exactly.
Others, or,
But he still let them interpret, you know, put their own spin on the way these characters developed on the stories. So he's just... I mean, as far as, and with dialogue and developing relationships, I mean, I just don't think there's anyone better than Joss Whedon.
No,
he's amazing.
That's why I'm really excited for that first Avengers trailer that came out, because you can tell already he's working on interrelationships. You have these giant characters, but it's going to be about how they get along a lot, which I think is a great touch.
That's why, and I never understood something like Firefly, why that didn't... Take
why
off.
Why it didn't resonate with audiences
exactly.
more? Yeah. I mean, obviously, resonate with its audience.
Well, and now, you know, I mean, it's just cult status, but it's just amazing to me. I anything that he does just has that touch, and it's human, and you know, it just resonates with people.
Did you take that to heart? Have you planned out? Did you plan out the Anna Strong series from the beginning?
Or? And I wish I had. I wish I had. But you know, that's one of the things about the publishing business too, because you really never know how many books you're going to be able to write.
Right, right.
It's such a crazy business, and it is a business. So the publisher looks at the bottom line, and as long as you keep making the money, you know, they'll probably keep giving you contracts. But the minute that falls off, or the minute you don't make their expectations, then they move on to the next author. It's really a cutthroat business. It's hard. It's really hard. It's funny because I didn't really think I was going to be able to come up with a character that I liked as much as Anna Strong. But I am developing a new series that I really like. It's a different character.
Can you
and I'm
speak?
Not.
You can't talk about
I'm
it.
I'm not going to say anything, but I don't
Well, you've got two
it.
More of these books. I understand. I mean, can't promote the next thing too soon.
But it's like, stay tuned.
All right. we certainly will. So, do you consider your work more urban fantasy, not so much of a paranormal romance?
Exactly. Yeah.
So the fans of urban fantasy, they're absolutely voracious readers.
Right.
What's your relationship with your fans like?
Oh, I love the fans of urban fantasy. But, you know, I have to say, too, that about paranormal romance readers like urban fantasy as well.
Okay.
But they want to know that it's an urban fantasy and not a romance.
Interesting.
That's the difference. That's why I really like the tag of urban fantasy, because it doesn't romance readers, I mean, well, they buy more books than any other, you know,
certainly
really,
do, yeah.
any other segment.
They keep the industry
reading.
Going in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they, as I said, will read anything, but if you present a book as a romance and it's not, that you've antagonized a lot of people.
Very interesting.
So when they came up with the urban fantasy tag, it mainly was to differentiate these books from paranormal romance.
Did that happen during the course of your career, or
just before my book started being published?
Did that help? Did that help pave the way for you to to find your place
absolutely.
In the industry?
Yeah,
very
absolutely,
yeah.
It did. Because as I said, romance readers, I think probably 60% of my readership are paranormal romance readers. They read both.
Right.
And as long as they know, as I said, that I'm not trying to present an urban fantasy book as a paranormal romance.
Sure.
They like the stories.
How has this genre, or this subgenre, changed in the last decade?
I don't know that it has changed that much, because urban fantasy basically is a contemporary novel set in our world, set in the real world, but with a twist, with paranormal creatures, you know, that live either you know, above ground or below ground in this society. So it really hasn't changed, and it's been around for a long time. It just didn't have that tag.
That tag.
Because everything Anne Rice, everything, I mean, Bram Stoker's Dracula, if you look at it in the context of what it is, is an urban fantasy.
Right.
I always like to say the first urban fantasy I think I ever read was Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby. And that was, what, in the 50s, I think, late 50s, early 60s, that was published. And that's an urban fantasy. But they just didn't have that.
Very interesting.
That tag. Yeah.
You're very active in the Denver writers community.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what that's like.
Well, I do credit actually getting published to Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers. Mm-hmm. I joined that the second year I moved here to Denver, and I've lived here, I think, 17 years now. And I came to one of their conferences and joined, and through that group, I got into a critique group.
Okay.
And I had always been in critique groups in San Diego, which is where I'm from as well. But I realized when I got into a real critique group that what we called a critique group was really kind of a support, you know, touchy-feely, you know, this is so good. But never really, and I think a lot of that is because I didn't really know how to critique at that time. I mean, I didn't know the craft. I knew that I liked to write stories. I knew that I loved to write. I didn't really know how to write, though. And it really took joining a critique group with serious writers, many of whom were published or soon to be published, to make me realize what it means to write a good story.
So what was that like then when you're you know, coming to maybe your first critique group meeting, and all of a sudden you have someone that's not just like, oh, good job.
Oh, absolutely.
did you have a moment of like, just sort of shock by it?
Yeah, and the first critique group that I went to was run by a gentleman by the name of Jim Cole, Jameson Cole, and he had a book called A Killing in Quail County, which won a Colorado Book Award and won, I think, several Kansas Book Award, and it was a literary novel, coming of age novel, and he had very strict rules of writing, and and at first, I mean, it kind of took me aback, especially when at this particular critique group, you presented your writing, but then you couldn't say anything else. You couldn't argue your points or explain.
The work had to stand on its own.
Exactly. Yeah. You just had to sit there.
And you're in the room and there.
And Oh, yes. You're in the room and you go through this. But once I got used to it and once I got to understand, exactly what he was talking about, and of course he gave us books to read, and he was just a wonderful writing teacher. And I realized that he was so right about so many things. He eventually moved away, but the core of that group stayed together. Mario Acevedo, as a matter of fact, is one of the members of the critique group. We stayed together. And I think we did change our rules, though, so that we could discuss things.
The new boss in town.
Exactly. We weren't such hard taskmasters, We kind of bent the rules. But it was just amazing to me that within a period of about 2 years, I think there were six of us at that time and four of us got contracts and got published within that time.
That is remarkable.
So it really is remarkable, and it just shows you that, if you get into the right critique group and you learn the craft and you realize that it's not just telling a story, you can have the best story in the world, but if you don't know how to write it, then it's not going to go over.
How much of the discussions were about the actual merits of the content versus how do you market the content? Because I mean, it's kind of an unfortunate challenge that writers have to figure out a way to sell publishers.
Well,
that's
very true. But we never address that.
Interesting.
Yeah,
and we still all and
we're,
two,
yes,
yeah, still
yes,
four to six
we're
months.
Still all together. Yeah. But we don't. Every once in a while we'll have a conversation about marketing. Mm-hmm. But that's never enters into the way we look at the material that we're writing. And we have a sci-fi writer, we have urban fantasy, we have YA writers, we have a romance writer in our group. But the basic rules of writing are the same. Good writing is good writing.
Right.
So you can judge any kind of writing.
Yeah, Gardner as well was in here earlier saying that he would feel comfortable doing an anthology of cowboy stories because the principles of writing are
exactly
all the same.
Exactly.
Now, you've mentioned in interviews your love for the straight mystery genre.
Yes.
Have you been shopping any mystery novels? Any planned? Or?
No, I still have an idea for one in the back of my head, but I'm kind of pigeonholed right now in the paranormal.
And so you think you're going to... Yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't achieved that last big hurdle. I made the New York Times bestseller list twice with anthologies that I've been in.
Okay.
But I haven't made it on my Anna Strong books. I haven't made one of those big lists on the Anna Strong books.
Right.
So I still have that hurdle to get over. So with this new series, I'm hoping that I will do that. And after that, after I've really established myself, exactly, then I have the freedom to try to, that's the most wonderful thing when somebody comes to you and says, oh, what else do you have? what other ideas do you have? We want to publish more.
So as one of the more successful writers in the area, do you find yourself taking on a mentoring role with up-and-coming writers?
I haven't done that as much as I think I should, and mainly because of time constraints. I'm always under a deadline of one kind or another. I've been, I have a lot of short stories going out in anthologies, too. So besides the novels, they're the short stories as well. So I haven't had that much time. Now, in our critique group, we have added a couple of newer writers, but they're not brand new writers.
Gotcha.
They are both, actually, we you know, we kind of interview if we're going to
add. I was
going
to say, you're a fairly prestigious critique group, at least, especially for the Denver area.
It's just that it's really hard if you start with a brand new writer, unless they have an MFA or unless they're, you know, they've really studied this, they make all the newbie mistakes. And sure. It's like starting over. One critique group that I belonged to before our core group formed, it was just that way. And it seemed like we had two or three new people every time, and we were starting over every time, you know, going over the basics. And it really kind of takes away from where your focus, is. So I know it sounds selfish.
No, not at all. It's actually very interesting. I mean, at a convention like this, I'm sure many of the attendees are people who are interested in becoming writers themselves.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's a discussion you'll be having throughout the week.
Oh, yes, it is. And I love talking one-on-one. I mean, I will do that. I've talked to a lot of new writers who will ask me questions and things, and I love to talk and answer questions. But as far as mentoring, I just don't feel like I have the time to give it to someone.
Makes me think of... it was an industrialist that said when he was talking about mastermind groups, but the little steel sharpened steel idea, like when you do have a core group of people who are all more experienced, more at the top of their game,
we're all at the same level. You know, we're all more or less at the same level, so that it's not a constant, you know, regression to look at our work. So yeah.
Well, excellent. Okay, one last question for you.
Sure.
Just gonna throw this out there. Spike or Angel?
Oh, Spike. Oh, my God.
That's the only choice.
No,
all right.
No. And, you know, oh, gosh, yeah. No.
So that's an easy one?
And I have to say, you know, kind of geek girl that I am, I have I have all the Spike action figures.
Awesome.
I have all those things.
I saw
the
celebratory post about James Marsters as well. Yeah,
I know. And I love Dragon Con because he's always at Dragon Con. That's one of the cons I just love to go to every year because he's usually there and it's just fun. And I never, you know, I never get up enough nerve to actually talk to him. I met Joss Whedon once, though, at a Comic-Con, and that was very cool. I will always remember that. That was great.
Does this convention kind of have a hometown turf feeling to it? Do you feel like this is when you're most in your element?
That is an interesting question because, I feel more at home, really, at like a Comic-Con or Dragon Con, and I think it's because there are more... Like our League of Reluctant Adults, they're usually at least, I think there are 13 or 14 in that group, and they're usually at least 6 or 7 that attend these big conferences. And so it's kind of more fun, to kind of hang around and cause trouble. And,
absolutely.
You know. And this one, I always feel like I have to, except with Mario, because he's always a bad influence. But you two
are very close friends, right?
We are very close friends, but don't tell him I said that.
Okay. I promise I won't.
No, don't tell him.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
This was a pleasure to have you. Thank you. This went so fast.
It's been going fast for us as well, which is a little bit spooky.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you.